we're talking about risk-free rates, right? And remember, the definition of a risk-free rate is long-term and it's default-free. Right? Keyword is default-free. And that's part of the reason the last example I did in class last Wednesday was with the Indian rupee. Where I said I want a risk-free rate in Indian rupees. I start with the Indian government bond rate, but I don't stop there because it's not default-free. And I take out the default risk. So we're going to start with that today. But let's start with our usual start of the class test, because a couple of issues that we will talk about today that I want to kind of see if we can get out of the way right now. So let's say you've been asked to estimate the risk-free rate for a Swiss multinational. Okay? And it gets its revenues in the following way. It gets 10% of its revenues in Switzerland in Swiss francs, 30% of its revenues in the EU in euros, 40% of its revenues in the US in US dollars, and 20% of its revenues in Indian rupees. That's actually not that unusual a company. If you look at most multinationals now, I mean, I've stopped at four countries, but you could have 30 different countries and 30 different currencies. You're trying to value the company. Okay? I've given you the risk-free rates in each of the four currencies they're involved in. 0.5% in Swiss francs, 1% in euros, 2.5% in US dollars, 6% in Indian rupees. You have to pick a risk-free rate to do your valuation. And I'll give you some choices. And I go through these, tell me whether it works. And if it doesn't work, tell me why not. Okay? And the reason I want you to tell me why not is I've seen all of these used in valuation with very strange logic backing them up. Let's see if you can dispel whatever misconceptions people bring into it. So the first two choices are averages. Either a simple average, where I add the four numbers up and divide by four, or a weighted average. Anybody think that's the way to go? Okay, that was the easy answer. No, but now I'm going to ask you why. Why shouldn't I use a weighted average of the risk-free rates? We do weighted averages of everything else. We'd be using weighted averages of equity risk premiums. We'd be using weighted averages of betas. Why can't we use weighted averages of risk-free rates? What's a risk-free rate? It's an occurrence, right? A currency is a measurement mechanism. And if you have two different measurement mechanisms, averaging them out is going to give you absolute and complete nonsense. Let me give you a very, very simplistic example. If you're from anywhere outside the U.S., you measure temperature in centigrades, right? So let's assume that today the temperature in Frankfurt is 25 degrees centigrade. Temperature in New York is measured in Fahrenheit. Today it's about, let's say, 75. If I said the average temperature across the two cities is 75 plus 25 divided by 2, you see how absurd that is? That's like you giving your weight in kilograms and I giving it to you in pounds, and we're averaging the two numbers. Risk-free rates in different currencies cannot mix. I don't care whether you take simple averages, weighted averages, it doesn't make any sense to bring different risk-free rates into the same valuation. So now let's look at the possible choices. I could use the Swiss franc rate, the argument being it's a Swiss company, therefore I should use the Swiss franc rate. What's wrong with that logic? Am I required to value every Swiss company in Swiss francs? No, I could take Nestle and it might be easier for me to value it in British pounds or euros or dollars than it is in Swiss francs, right? So just because a company is an Indian company doesn't mean I have to value it in rupees. Okay? The lowest of the rates, why? What difference does it make? The logic I've heard is, if it's a lowest rate, it must be the risk-free rate. So all the other rates are risky because they're higher. If they're all risk-free rates, the reason they're different is because they're in different currencies, not because one is less. It's not that the Swiss franc is less risky than the euro, which is less risky than the dollar. It's just that you have different expected inflation rates built into them. It's not the highest either, because that doesn't make any sense. You just pick the highest number, so I'm being conservative. So what's the answer? I've kind of ruled out all five here. So what should I do? If I ask you what risk-free rate should I use in my valuation, what's the question you need to ask me? What currency am I doing my cash flows in, right? If I decide to value Nestle and I tell you my cash flows are all going to be in U.S. dollars, the risk-free rate you will use is a U.S. dollar risk-free rate. If I do all my cash flows in Swiss francs, the risk-free rate I will use is a Swiss franc risk-free rate. And for the moment, you're probably saying, but the Swiss franc risk-free rate is so much lower. Won't I get a higher value? Hold on to that thought, because we're going to come back and show, hopefully today, that you can value Nestle in Swiss francs, euros, US dollars, or Indian rupees. And if you do it right, and that's a big if, you should get exactly the same value for Nestle in any currency that you value it. It sounds tricky. It sounds almost impossible because the rates are different. But you're going to see another piece come into play that allows things to average out. So we'll come back and talk about risk-free rates. We're also going to talk about equity risk premiums today. And the prevailing wisdom on equity risk premiums is you use historical premiums. That's the way most banks do it, most consulting firms do it. Sounds fancy, but here's what you do. You take a slice of history, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. You look at what you'd have made investing in stocks over that period and investing in something risk-free. And you have to define what that is, T-bonds, T-bills, government bonds, whatever it is. And the difference between those two numbers is called a historical risk premium. So let's say you decide to go down that route, because that's the place you work at uses historical premiums. You're trying to come up with a historical risk premium to use in your valuation. Remember, your objective in valuation is to do what? Forecast the cash flows, discount them back to today, right? So you're trying to decide how long you should go back to get the historical risk premium. So I'll give you the choices, and you tell me again, as I go through each choice, whether that choice is okay or whether it could get you into trouble. Just 1 year. What if I take the last year to get my risk premium? What's the problem I'm going to run into? This is a stock market, right? So if this were January 1st of 2009 and I took the last year, what's my risk premium going to look like? A big negative number. If I take a big negative number and feed it into my premium for the future, I'm going to end up with some really strange looking discount rates. I'll end up with negative discount rates. So 1 year is a drop in time. I mean, it really doesn't even mean much. Even 5 years is not very long. It sounds like a long time period in human time, but in stock market time, 5 years, anything can happen. You can have 5 years over which you can lose money, 5 years over which you can make 50% returns. So 1 of 5 is off the table. I've seen people actually use this logic of my risk-free rate is a 10-year T-bond rate. Therefore, my risk premium has to be a 10-year risk premium. Don't get stuck in this false desire to be consistent. Those are two different numbers. They have nothing to do with each other. So the fact that you're using a forward-looking 10-year risk-free rate doesn't mean you've got to estimate a risk premium by looking at the last 10 years. So it's not A, it's too short. Not B, because, you know, it's too short too. Not C, because it has nothing to do with the risk-free rate. And none of those actually really matter when you think about historical risk premium. So don't try to come up with a period for risk premium by looking at, hey, did I use 5 years for my beta? It really is irrelevant. In fact, I'm going to go further. There are people who say, if you tell me what currency you estimate your risk free rate in, then everything has to be estimated because the risk premium has to be for that market. That's not true either. So in fact, nothing you do in your cost of equity should drive your risk premium choice. In fact, with historical risk premiums, as you've seen, short time period risk premiums are close to useless. And by short time periods, I'm including 20, 25, 30 year premiums, are so incredibly noisy, and I'll back this up as to how noisy they are, that you might as well not even look at them. They really tell you nothing. Now, one more point about historical risk premiums. So let's say you've computed a historical risk premium by going back over the last 50 years. You come up with a number. Say you came up with 5%. Let's say the next year is a terrible year for stocks. It's a crisis year. Markets drop 50%. What's going to happen to your historical risk premium if you add that year to your number? Because remember, it's just adding up numbers and dividing by 50 or 60 or 70, right? So now you've added one really bad year to your sample. What's going to happen to your historical risk premium? Is it going to go up or down? You add a really bad year, it's going to come down, right? You're saying, so what? This was a crisis year. You're feeling really scared about stocks, right? And when you get really scared about stocks, what would you intuitively do to your equity risk premium? You raise the price for risk or lower the price for risk when you're really scared? You'd raise the price of risk. Instead, what are you doing with historical risk premiums? You're actually pushing it down. It's one of those reasons, again, to be very suspicious about historical risk premiums is because they'll always push you in the wrong direction. When you're most scared, they'll say, oh, you can take a 3% premium. When you're feeling most buoyant, they'll say, well, You know, so it really cuts in the wrong direction. There's no way out with historical premiums, but that's again something to factor in. One of the things we're going to talk about is forward-looking premiums, and it's easy as I go through the approach I'm going to describe to think it's really complicated. But I'm going to use a very simple example to illustrate, at least set up what these forward-looking premiums are. So I'm going to pick somebody. I'm going to pick Chris as my example. Right? So don't worry. So there's no right answer. Actually, there are a few wrong answers, but I'm sure you won't give me any of those. Let's assume that I came to you with an investment where I promised you a dollar every year in perpetuity with certainty, with absolute certainty. So you know, so there's no default risk. You guarantee a dollar. How much did you pay for this investment?
Right now?
$10. Okay. When you say, actually, let's back it up. So if you pay $10 and you make a dollar, what's your rate of return you're going to make then each year on that investment?
10%.
It's a guaranteed investment, right? Do you think I'm going to sell it to you for $10? If in fact, if I open it up for bidding, you'd like to get it for 10, right? But then you're making a 10% rate of return guaranteed in a market where your risk-free rate, if you know, even if you use the 10-year, is close to what, 2.5% or so? So you're right, you can bid $10, but if I open this up for bidding, somebody else is probably going to say, I'll pay 15, I'll pay 20. And in fact, if this were a legitimate bidding process, and you truly believed me when I said this is risk-free and perpetual, roughly speaking, what's the price you're going to end up with? 1 over 0.025, which is roughly $40, right? So when you pay $40, you're going to earn 2.5%, which is roughly equal to the risk-free rate. So let's assume we ended up at the bidding at $40. Now, once you got the $40, now let me introduce some risk into the process. Let's assume now that I promise you the same $1 I did before, but now it's not guaranteed. It's got risk in it. How much risk? As much risk as there is in the average equity. I know that's an incredibly diffuse statement because you have no idea. But I want you to put your own frame of reference on what the riskiness of the average equity is. And I ask you, how much would you pay for this investment now? Amishi, would you pay less than 40 or more than 40 now?
Less than 40.
Less than 40. Give me a number.
20.
She's just given me a risk premium. You see why? If you pay $20 for this, what's the rate of return you're settling for? 5%. Subtract out the risk-free rate, you got an equity risk premium. Now, it's a little unfair to make you give a number because but that's essentially what we're going to do when we do implied equity risk premiums. We're going to look at what people pay for stocks because that's like a Amishi offering $20. We're going to back out from it an internal rate of return given the cash flows and then compare it to the risk-free rate. And we're going to have a forward-looking premium based on what you pay, not what you say. That's the essence of forward-looking premiums. It's not fancy. I'm just going to look at what people pay and back up. So the less you pay, the larger the risk premium you're demanding, right? Because the more risk-averse you become, the more scared you become, the less you're going to be willing to pay for that. So if you say, I'll pay only $10 instead of $20, your equity risk premium just went up to 7.5%. If you pay only $5, your equity risk premium went up to 17.5%. It's as simple as that. So when we talk about equity risk premiums, today we're going to spend almost the bulk of our time talking about historical risk premiums. But I'm also going to be very skeptical about using this number in evaluation because this is a backward-looking number. What I want is a forward-looking dynamic number that reflects where we are today in the market. And only a forward-looking premium will give me that. Okay, so let me set this aside. I'm going to go back to page 31, which is where we are in our lecture note packet. So and I'm going to flesh out a little bit because in the last session, remember I took the Indian rupee and I backed out a risk-free rate. I start with the government bond rate, then I subtracted a default spread, right? 2.2%. And that seemed to come out of left field. You're saying, where do you get that 2.2%? So today what I want to start off with is, if you have a currency where you worry that there's default risk, how do you come up with a default spread to take out the government bond rate? I sent you an email with updated numbers for each of these, but I'll take you back to January 2014 and work through the numbers for one currency. And if you truly want to kind of grapple with risk-free rates, my suggestion is go back and take that email with the updated numbers. Pick any currency you want. Pick the most obscure currency you can think of, Nigerian Naira. See if you can compute a risk-free rate. Because once you can do that, then you should be able to compute a risk-free rate in euros. So in a sense, set the standards up where you take difficult currencies and work with them. So here are your three choices to come up with default spreads. The first is, if you can find dollar or euro-denominated bonds issued by an emerging market, a sovereign, you can compare it to something risk-free. So if you have a Brazilian 10-year dollar-denominated bond, you can compare it to the UST bond rate, and you can come up with a default spread for that country. If you have a Polish euro-denominated bond, you can compare it to what? What should I be comparing it to? The German euro bond rate, you can go. So the first choice is to see if you can find a dollar euro denominated bond. There are about 30 or 35 countries where you're going to be able to get this. You can get a default spread for those. The second is to go to the sovereign CDS market. Okay? Basically, in the CDS market, you buy insurance against default risk. You get a price for that. It's like a default spread. So you go to the sovereign CDS market, you can get sovereign CDS spreads for about 70 countries. You can use those as the default spreads and come up with a risk-free rate and move on. So you can use a dollar-denominated bond, a sovereign CDS market, or if you cannot do either of the first two, here's what you can do. If you can find a sovereign rating for your country, preferably a local currency rating, because remember, you can get two ratings for any country, a local currency or a foreign currency rating. The local currency rating measures the default risk that Moody's or S&P sees in that country when it issues bonds in the local currency. Take that rating, and there's a lookup table I'm going to show you, and I'll give you where the lookup table comes from, so it's not some magical number, and you can estimate a default spread based on that rating. So let's try this out. This is January 2014. I went and looked up the local currency government bond rates in different currencies, and I sent you the link from Thursday. That's actually, it's one of the best links I found, because until I found that link, I had to go find these rates one by one, sometimes through Google search. Even Bloomberg doesn't carry local currency government bond rates. Okay? So I started with that page. So these were the local currency government bond rates by currency. Okay? Somebody do me a favor and run downstairs and tell that there's a guy, just knock on the, push the door open, just tell him until noon not to drill, do whatever he's doing. No, thank you so much. Don't worry, I won't say no state secrets while you're gone. Okay? So basically, these are the local currency government bond rates, but they're not risk-free rates. Okay? So these are not dollar bonds, these are not euro bonds, these are local currency government bond rates by currency. And there's some obscure currencies here, right? Because most of us don't think of the Icelandic krona on a daily basis, but there are about 45 different currencies. To go from this to a risk-free rate, I need default spread. So I'll give you the first choice. You can compare dollar-euro-denominated bond rates to the USD bond rate or the German-euro bond rate, right? Every day in the FT, the Financial Times, you see a little box. So this is actually the quickest way to get this. You can also pull it off Bloomberg. But let's say you don't have access to Bloomberg. You go to the Financial Times. It says bonds, high yield, and emerging market. So these are government sovereign bonds issued by emerging market governments in dollars or in euros. So let's take it as an example, Brazil. Let's suppose your job is to get a risk-free rate for Brazil. Let me go back to the previous page. The government bond rate in reais is 13.21%. I want to take out of that the default spread, right? So here's your first choice. According to the FT, there are two listings for Brazil. You're saying, which one should I use? Remember, you want a risk-free rate that's more long-term than short-term. So even though I can find a 2015 bond, I'd much rather have a longer-term bond. So I'm going to go with the 2020 bond. January 2020 expiration, or the maturity bond, a Brazilian dollar-denominated bond, the yield on that bond is 3.93%. You say, what do I do with that? That's what you're going to pay for a Brazilian 7-year bond, roughly speaking, at the start of 2014. 3.93%. The 7-year U.S. T-bond at that point in time had a rate of 2.43%. See what I'm going to do next? I have a 7-year dollar-denominated Brazilian bond. I have the 7-year U.S. T-bond rate. I'm going to assume the U.S. Thank you. I'm going to assume the U.S. Treasury has no default risk, and that difference of 1.5% becomes my first measure for the default risk in Brazil. Okay? Any questions? In fact, the FD screws up on this table. Do you see where it screws up? It actually computes a spread. It's very helpful. I'm glad they do it. They compute the spread over the U.S. T-bond for all the U.S. dollar bonds. You see where the screw-up happens? They also compute the spread for the euro bonds over the U.S. T-bond. Why they do it, I don't know. It's completely and totally... But this is what I mean about sloppiness with currencies. People don't even think about what currency they're talking about. So if you were to redo this table, be careful about those euro bonds because you have to replace the U.S. T-bond with the German 10-year euro bond rate. And today that rate is close to 1%. So it'll make a big difference what the spreads are if you replace those numbers. Justin?
So you're using a 7-year bond here.
Yeah.
Does it matter if it's 7, 8, 9?
No, you've got to match up to whatever the emerging market bond is. So the longer, the closer you can get to 10, the better. But often you have no choice. You're going to take the best you can. In fact, for Mexico, I was trying to get a risk-free rate last week because I have to go to Mexico in a couple of weeks and I wanted a risk-free rate in pesos. And they, I had a choice of a 3 or a 17-year. So, but again, since the spread is what matters, as long as I can get the 17-year and compare it to 17, because I can find UST bonds in every maturity. So all I need to do is find as close as I can to that. But I have to be careful to match up. I can't compare a 7-year dollar-denominated Brazilian bond to a 10-year T-bond. Any other questions? So that's the first one. I'm sorry, the first choice. Let's go and take the second choice. January 2014, I looked up CDS spreads. These are sovereign CDS spreads. You can also get corporate CDS spreads, but we don't care about those. So these are sovereign CDS spreads by country. Okay? So basically, this is every country for which there was a CDS spread in January 2014. If you use the Bloomberg terminal, it's very difficult to get these CDS spreads from a public score. So you can't get it online. It's not easy to get. You can get individual countries. But if you go to Bloomberg and type in SOBR, that's the Bloomberg command, you'll actually get the whole, every single sovereign CDS spread. So these are the CDS spreads. Again, let me focus on Brazil. Remember again, I got a 1.5% spread by looking at the dollar-denominated bond, right? Let's look at Brazil. In January 2014, according to the CDS market, the default spread for Brazil is 2.5%. There are a couple of caveats I would add about the CDS market. I love having access to the market. Why? Because it's a constantly updated database that I can use for those 70 countries. But the CDS market comes with its own flaws. One of the flaws in the CDS market is there is counterparty risk. You know what I mean by counterparty risk? What did I say the CDS market was? You're buying insurance. Your insurance is only as good as the person who sold you the insurance, right? And unfortunately, in the CDS market, there's counterparty risk. That's why when Lehman collapsed in 2008, it almost dragged this entire market down because Lehman had been a significant counterparty on so many of the contracts. Which effectively means that if you look at the CDS, the sovereign CDS spreads across countries, there isn't a single country with a zero sovereign CDS spread. According to the CDS market, there are no risk-free countries. Which strikes me as a little strange. In fact, the lowest, I think, was Sweden, maybe, 0.39%. Sweden, Switzerland, around 0.39, 0.4. So there seems to be some residual spread that shows up, even if a country is close to risk-free. If that's a problem we face, and you're using a sovereign CDS spread, is there an easy way I can get rid of that problem? In other words, I can't get a zero base, right? The base seems to be around 0.40%. So what could I use as my CDS spread for Brazil if that is my concern, is the CDS market inflates the price of insurance because of its internal problems? I'll give you my simplistic solution. I take the lowest sovereign CDS spread I can find, and I subtract it from every number, which effectively means that Sweden will go to zero, and Brazil will go from 2.532 to 2.14%. Very simplistic. But if that is your concern, that is one way to deal with it, is take that lower spread out of every single number. You've got an adjusted default spread which gets updated every minute of every day. Any questions on the sovereign CDS market? So that'll give you spreads for about 70 countries, right? So we've gone from 30 to 70. That's good. But there are about 180 countries in the world, some of which you might never care about, but there are a lot of other countries we don't have a spread for. So I'll give you the third approach. Now we're hitting desperation time, right? You can't find a dollar-denominated bond. You can't find a sovereign CDS spread. Maybe you can find a local currency rating, a sovereign rating for your country. If you can find a rating for your country, then I'll give you a default spread for your country. So as an example, let's take Brazil. Brazil, I don't have a problem. I have the dollar bond, I have the CDS spread. But let's say for Brazil, I had neither of those. I have a rating for Brazil. It's Baa2. That's the Moody's rating. Implicitly, we're assuming that the ratings agencies do a decent job assessing sovereign risk, which is a dangerous assumption, but no. As I said, desperation calls for desperate choices. The default spread for a Baa-rated country at the start of 2014 is 1.90%. I create this lookup table at the start of every year. And there's nothing magical about it. You know how I create this lookup table? I take those 70 sovereign CDS spreads and the dollar-denominated bonds. I end up with a sample of about 85 countries for which I have default spreads, and I have the local currency ratings for each of them. Then I do a pivot table in Excel where I look for what the median default spread is or the average default spread is by credit rating. So basically, I take the 85 countries where I have a rating and either a CDS spread or a dollar-denominated bond to get a spread. Then I try to estimate, roughly speaking, what the spread is. And the reason I have to do that is for the other countries where I cannot find either a dollar bond or a CDS spread, I use the rating to come up with the default spread. So at this stage for Brazil, I have three different numbers for the default spread, right? 1.5% if I use the government bond, 2.53% if I use the sovereign CDS market, or 1.90% if I use the local currency rating. Which one I use will affect my risk-free rate, right? Because I'm subtracting it out from the 13.21%, which is the nominal real bond rate. I'm going to say something incredibly strange, but hang in there anyway. It doesn't matter which number you use as long as you stay consistent with that number for the rest of your valuation. Because at first sight, using a lower number gives me a higher risk-free rate, right? You're saying, that's bad. I'm going to use the higher number. If I use the higher number, in this case, the highest number I have is a sovereign CDS spread, I end up with a lower risk-free rate. But you know where it's going to revisit you in the valuation? The risk-free rate is only one of three inputs into your cost of equity. What are the other two? There's a beta, and there is a equity risk premium. Guess what? What one hand gives you, the other hand will take away. What I'm saying is don't spend 3 hours trying to pick. Just pick and move on. In fact, as a general rule, don't get stuck in valuation. Keep moving. So when you hit a roadblock, make an assumption, move on. You can always come back to the assumption. And this is one of those assumptions where as long as you don't end up being inconsistent, you're going to be okay. Any questions on getting a default spread? Damien.
Why didn't you subtract the lowest country CDS?
I could have. In fact, that would have been a fourth choice then. Then that I would have used the 2.14% as my number all the way through. The reason I didn't get too involved here is three choices is tough enough. You can have four choices. You can have five. I mean, you could subtract some people just take the U.S. CDS and subtract it from every number, which leaves you the weird result that you actually get a negative CDS spread for countries like Sweden, which have a lower spread than the U.S. But you're right. I could have netted out the U.S. or the sovereign or the Swedish CDS spread from the Brazilian spread. Any other questions? So that's getting a risk-free rate in any currency. So now we've looked at how to get a U.S. dollar risk-free rate. That was easy, right? If you assume the U.S. Treasury is default-free. In fact, I've now given you a way of dealing with what to do if the U.S. Treasury becomes default-ridden. Like tomorrow we woke up and the sovereign rating for the U.S. was dropped to AA. How would we have to estimate a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars? You'd start with a T-bond rate, but you wouldn't stop there, right? You'd have to subtract out the default spread for a AA-rated country. The world hasn't ended. Just because you lost your AAA rating, it just means you have a little more work to do to get to a risk-free rate. Now, let's complete the story with risk-free rates. Let's suppose you decide to do everything in real terms. Remember what we said, real basically means you take inflation out of your cash flows and you want a real discount rate. So you want a real risk-free rate. And I told you that the TIPS rate was a measure of a real risk-free rate, because it's what you guaranteed on an inflation-indexed treasury bond. And if you assume the treasury is default-free, you're in a sense guaranteed that rate of return. Start at 2014, that number was about 1%. Now, you almost never will be doing real valuations in the U.S. And there's a simple reason for that. The world operates in nominal terms. What I mean by that is your taxes are based on nominal income. You can't go to the government and say, my real income is much lower, can I pay you a lower real tax? So if you're given a choice, you'd much rather do things in nominal terms. And with well-behaved currencies, where the risk-free rate is not too strange, you're going to work in nominal terms. So what I'm trying to say is you can get a real risk-free rate in the U.S., but you almost never need it. You know why you're going to need a real risk-free rate? If you're valuing a company in Zimbabwe or Venezuela or Argentina, you say, look, I don't want to deal with inflation. I want to do everything in real terms. He's saying, I'll go find a TIPS bond issued by the Argentine government. First, even if you find it, it's not going to be risk-free, right? It's got default risk in it. So I have a question for you. It's clear the 1% rate is my risk-free rate that I got out of the TIPS. Can I use that as my real risk-free rate elsewhere in the world? In other words, in Argentina and Venezuela and Russia. And if I do, what is the assumption I need to make about global markets for that to be the risk-free rate? You see my question? I can get a real risk-free rate, but I get it in the U.S. The places where I need a real risk-free rate tend to be these offbeat markets. Can I use my TIPS rate as my risk-free rate? Or under what conditions can I use? You say rate is a real risk-free rate. What do you say? Basically, if I have no inflation, there's no currency attached to it. There is no real U.S. dollar risk-free rate. It's just a real risk-free rate. If capital can flow freely around the world, that's a big if, but if capital, you know what the real risk-free rate should be everywhere in the world? Let's say that I told you the real risk-free rate in the U.S. is 1%, and the real risk-free rate in Brazil is 4%. If capital can flow freely, what's going to happen? It's going to leave the U.S. and go to Brazil, and it's going to keep doing this too. So if you lived in a world with free and open capital movements across the world, then our job got really simple, because the real risk-free rate of 1% is going to be the real risk-free rate globally. I have some advice for you. If you're ever doing a real valuation, assume the global markets are nice and easy, everything moves, then your life got simpler. Use the risk-free rate. Let somebody else bring it up. Let's see if they've even thought through this well enough. You might get lucky. You might be able to get away with it. Because the reality is we don't live in a world with free and open movements of capital. The real risk-free rates will vary around the world. And I'll give you a very simple proxy you can use for the real risk-free rate. Take the real growth rate in that economy that you're looking at, and use that as your real risk-free rate. We'll come back and talk about why that tends to work. But if you're really desperate, you need a real risk-free rate and evaluation, you're working in Venezuela, and you say, my real growth rate long-term is 4%, use that as your real risk-free rate, and you're going to be okay in your valuation as long as you stick with that 4% real growth rate all the way through your valuation. So real risk-free rates, easy route out is use the TIPS rate as your real risk-free rate. The slightly messier solution is look at the real growth rate in that country. But do it only if you have to do things in real terms. Yes?
Can you talk a little more about, like, I don't understand, probably some risk.
No, but remember, we're assuming that basically, what's real? Do you remember what real interest rate, Econ 101, what are real interest rates? Basically, what I have to... In fact, I remember my econ class, we never talked in terms of money. It's apples. And I remember saying, why are you talking about apples? You have to give up 100 apples today for 103 apples in the future. The emphasis with real risk-free rates is in terms of goods and services. So when you borrow, you have to return whatever you borrowed with an extra 3% in goods and services. So when I say the real risk-free rate in an economy is 4%, You know what I'm also implicitly expecting the economy to do? Deliver at least 4% real growth. Now, I might say, isn't there a risk premium there? There might be. But as I said, it's an approximation anyway. Might as well do the best you can and kind of keep moving with that. But that's the logic here, is in the long term, your real risk-free rates and real growth rates have to kind of converge. Right? So now let's talk about what to do if you're valuing a company. Well, getting the risk-free rate, or are you looking at the choice in terms of risk-free rate? I've given you, so let's say you're valuing, so many of you are valuing emerging market companies. You're saying, what do I do the valuation in? I'd like you, if you can, to start with the local currency. Don't give up too quickly. So if you're valuing a Mexican company, start trying to do the valuation in Mexican pesos. Okay? And you can do that with the approach we talked about. Clean up the government bond rates, come up with a risk-free rate in pesos, do the valuation in pesos. If that doesn't work, you can try doing things in real terms, but then you'll have to confront the question of, do I use the TIPS rate as my risk-free rate? And you can try that. If you're still uncomfortable, here's a third choice. And do it only if you really get to that desperation point. Do your valuation in a different currency. You know, until about 5 years ago, all equity research in Brazil was done in U.S. dollar terms. For about 20 years, all equity research in Brazil was done in U.S. dollar terms. Capital budgeting at companies was done in U.S. dollar terms. Why? Because people did not want to deal with nominal reais in their valuation. They didn't want to deal with it in terms of uncertainty about inflation. You're really pushing the problem elsewhere in the valuation, but there's nothing wrong with switching to a different currency if you are consistent about staying with that currency all the way through. And we talk about cash flows, we'll talk about what that consistency requires. So do everything in the local currency if you can. That should be a starting point. If that doesn't work, try doing things in real terms, a little messier. And if that's still giving you trouble, then move on to U.S. dollars or euros or some currency where you feel more comfortable estimating the discount rate in that currency. So remember those bond rates that I showed you? I often estimate risk-free rates by currency. And I showed around the world. So when I was in Indonesia, I came up with my rupiah risk-free rate. And I'm in India, I show the rupee risk-free rate. And there's almost always somebody in the audience who says, that is really not the risk-free rate. They don't trust it. And there's a good reason for that. In the U.S., when we use the T-bond rate as a risk-free rate, we're using one of the most widely traded instruments. You can disagree with that number, but it's set by demand and supply. We'll talk about the Fed effect later, but set by demand and supply. It's a traded instrument. That is actually a traded rate. In much of the world, what you see as a government bond rate might not come from a traded market. It's almost more set by the government than by a market, which effectively means that you can look at the rate and say, no way, that rate doesn't make sense in the market that I'm in. So I'm going to give you a couple of ways of either checking the rate or replacing it. The first is to compute what's called a synthetic risk-free rate, and goes back to what I just said about a real risk-free rate being roughly equal to the real growth rate. Here's a simple way you can get a nominal risk-free rate in any currency. The only reason currencies matter is because of expected inflation, right? So if you can tell me what the expected inflation rate is in your country, I will add it to a real risk-free rate and say your risk-free rate in this currency is X percent. Okay? So here's an example. Let's assume you're in the Ukraine or Kazakhstan. You've tried everything. You cannot get a risk-free rate in the local currency. The fact that I can't even name the local currency tells you that I'm having trouble because, right, in any, what's a Kazakh currency? Whatever, right? But I told you expected inflation in this economy is 15%. Remember the TIPS rate was 1%? Here's a very simplistic risk-free rate in the local currency. Take the 1% TIPS rate, I'm playing that game of let's assume the risk-free rate is, the real risk-free rate is at 1%. Add the 15% inflation to it, you got a synthetic risk-free rate of 16%. Sounds incredibly simplistic, but you're going to see that it all evens out in the valuation because as long as that same inflation rate gets built into your cash flows, it doesn't matter. That's a great thing about this. It doesn't matter if you're wrong about inflation because as long as you build the same inflation rate into both your risk-free rate and into your cash flows, what's going to happen to it? Let's say you overestimate inflation. Your discount rate is going to be too high. Your cash flows are also going to be too high. The key in valuation is to make sure you have the same inflation assumptions feeding into your cash flows and discount rates, and a build-up approach or a synthetic risk-free rate takes care of that. Here's the other way you can get a local currency risk-free rate. And this is actually a suggestion I'd make for many of you working in, even if you decide to do a valuation in local currencies, is first do everything in U.S. dollars. In other words, estimate your cost of equity and cost of capital entirely in U.S. dollars. It's much simpler to do actually in dollars because all your spreads are dollar-based spreads, right? They come from dollar-based markets. So let's say you come up with a cost of capital of whatever in U.S. dollars. In this case, I've used a risk-free rate of let's say you've got a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars, T-bond rate. You need two more numbers to come up with a risk-free rate in your currency. One is the inflation rate in the U.S., and that's easy to get, right? How do I get it? It's the difference between two numbers. The T-bond rate and the TIPS rate, basically. The 3.04 minus 1, you're done. That's the inflation rate. So don't go asking macroeconomists. What do they know anyway? They don't have any real money riding on it, so they can give you any number they want. Take a market, back out from those two numbers. You've got the expected inflation in the U.S. Let's say it's 2%. The inflation rate in the local currency was 15%, right? So take the 3.04%. If you're feeling lazy, just add the 13%, the difference between the 15 and the 2. That'll give you about 16%. If you're feeling a little less lazy, compound it. There's a compounding effect, which gives you a cost of risk-free rate in the local currency of 16.17%. So if you really want a risk-free rate in a local currency, even if you cannot find a government bond, you can get up to it if you're willing to make an assumption about inflation. So let's close. Yes, go ahead, Damien.
In the first example,
yeah.
When we're talking about Kazakhstan, would it be more accurate to take the 15% inflation plus the real GDP growth?
You could, yeah. So basically the real GDP growth in Kazakhstan would then go in instead of the 1% rate. That's the synthetic rate as well. Then stay with that growth rate and that inflation all the way through in your valuation. Okay. So in fact, you could create synthetic risk-free rates for the entire world by adding up real growth and expected inflation in each country. And you can get both those numbers going to the World Bank. You know, basically you take the statistics, add them up. And it's a very simplistic but a very powerful way of thinking about why risk-free rates vary across countries and across currencies. Any other questions? So let me pull up all these risk-free rates. And in a sense, we already know the answer, but let's make sure we get it nailed down. Here are the risk-free rates by currency from Japanese yen, where the risk-free rate is less than 1%, to Nigerian naira, where it's in excess of 10%. Start of 2014. Like the last one, I think, is Brazilian real. I skipped one and now. So the Nigerian naira is only less than 10%, but the Brazilian real is about 11%. So risk-free rates obviously vary across currencies. Holding all else constant, if I decide to do my valuation in Japanese yen or Swiss francs, I'm going to have a lower discount rate than if I do my same valuation in nominal riyals or Nigerian naira. It's absolutely always going to be the case. Now, we know DCF valuation, the higher the discount rate, the lower the value, right? So at first sight, you're saying, I should value my company in some real low, in this case, I should value it in Swiss francs or Japanese yen, I'll get a much higher value. But there's another shoe waiting to drop. And we kind of talk about why, if these are truly risk-free rates, and I've cleaned up a default risk in them, what's the only reason they're different across currencies? Inflation. Which means that the low inflation currencies have really low rates, and the high inflation currencies have really high rates. So if I replace my high inflation currency with a low inflation currency, it's true my discount rates will be lower, but my cash flows and my growth rates are also going to be lower in exactly the proportional form. I know it sounds like an outlandish claim, but later on when we value companies, I'm going to value Tata Motors in Indian rupees, then I'm going to value it in U.S. dollars at exactly the same time with the same information. And I'm going to come up with the same value for the company using both currencies. And that is an incredibly convenient result right now. Because in a sense, it tells you, pick a currency and do it right. Because if you do it right, you should get the same value for the company no matter what currency you switch to. So everybody comfortable with risk-free rates? Why they vary across currencies? The reason I emphasize this is a skill set. No matter what you decide to do, fixed income, equities, corporate finance, marketing, strategy, maybe not strategy. Right. No. Whatever you decide to do, you've got to work across currencies. You're going to be negotiating with people who think in a different currency. If you're just U.S. dollar focused, you're going to be taken to the cleaners over and over and over again because your frame of reference has gotten frozen around the U.S. dollar frame of reference. So you need to be comfortable moving across currencies, and it's not difficult to do if you make it. So don't get caught up in exchange rate forecasts and what currencies are strong. Let the macro guys do that. You just focus on what matters to you in valuation, which is differences in inflation are the only thing that drive why different currencies matter to me in valuation. Everything else is a side story. There's one final point I want to make. What's the T-bond rate right now? About 2.5%. I don't want a precise answer. It's about 2.5%, right? What's the euro risk-free rate right now? It's about 1%. Think, so what? We're in a period where risk-free rates are at historic lows. Let's not go into why that is, QE1, QE2, Titanic, etc., all of them floating around in there. But set that to the side, we're at a period of really low risk-free rates. You see where this is going next? It makes people really uncomfortable because when you think risk-free rates are too low, a lot of analysts do, what's the inclination you have? When something looks too low, you're inclined to try to replace it with something more normal, right? And people are doing it all over the place, and they're mangling valuations. In fact, I'm going to play the role of somebody who does it. You tell me why I shouldn't be doing it. I've given away the answer already, but I want you to tell me what's wrong with what I'm doing. So basically, this was the start of 2014. The T-bond rate was 3.04%, which it's actually gone down since. I'm an analyst, and I decide to replace that with a normalized rate. What would my normalized rate be? It depends on how old I am. And I'm not being facetious. If you're 50 years old, you think a normal risk-free rate is 5%. If you're about 40 years old, you think a normal risk-free rate is about 4%. If you're about 25 years old, you think a normal risk-free rate is 2%. Why? Because your frame of reference is often how long have I been in the market, what have I seen? And that's already a problem, right? Because what we call normal is not some mathematical precise number. It reflects our experience with that number. So here's the question I have for you. I have the 3.04%. Let's assume that my definition of normal gives me 5 to 6%. That's a 30-year average of the 10-year bond rate. Can I replace my 3.04% with 5 to 6% because it's a more normal number? This is a more pragmatic question. If I replace my 3.04% 5 to 6%, which is a higher risk-free rate, what's going to happen to my discount rate holding all its constant? It's going to push up my discount rate, right? When I push up my discount rate, what's going to happen to my value? It's going to push. In fact, I guarantee you, with about a 6% risk-free rate, nothing in the market is going to look cheap to you. Nothing. So you're going to conclude that I shouldn't be invested in stocks. So what are you going to do now? You're now going to invest at 5 to 6%. Where are you going to find this? You just made up a normalized rate. Now do you see why risk-free rates are numbers you don't want to mess with? They're opportunity costs. If you don't invest in stocks today, guess what? You're going to be making only 2.5% on the T-bond. You can say, I wish I was making 4. I think I should be making 5. But it doesn't matter. That is the actual opportunity cost today. My suggestion with risk-free rates is don't mess with them. Don't replace them with what you think is normal. Don't replace it because it really is none of your business. You've been asked to value a company given where rates are today. Just value the company. If I wanted your views about interest rates, I'd ask you, what do you think about interest rates? And you can tell me whatever you want. I'm asking, what's the value of Coca-Cola? Why are you telling me what you think about interest rates? That's precisely what happens when you replace today's T-bond rate with an average rate. So this is not an unusual practice now. I see about a third of all the DCF valuations, I see, replace risk-free rates with what they think should be normal. Okay. And here's the other point I want to make. Risk-free rates don't get set in a vacuum, right? The forces that drive risk-free rates also affect everything else in the economy. In fact, what's the standard reason given for why risk-free rates are so low today? You read it over and over again in the Wall Street Journal. It's the fact that the Fed has QE, the quantitative easing plans of the Fed, right? So you think the Fed is what's kept interest rates low for the last 5 years? Let's take the U.S. You think the Fed's? Seems to be the conventional wisdom, right? See the second page I handed out? I'm going to pull that graph up because this is something I want you to hold on to because it's going to be a good weapon to use. When people talk about how the Fed sets interest rates. Okay? So let me take you through what this graph is. First, see this line over here? That's the 10-year T-bond rate from 1954 through 2013. So 10-year T-bond rate climbs to... You know. See these two lines? The green is the inflation rate, and the purple is the real GDP growth rate. So what I've done each year is I've taken the inflation rate and added the GDP growth rate each year to come up with what I'm going to call a fundamental. Remember how I came up with the synthetic risk-free rate? I've compared the actual T-bond rate to what the rate would be if I added up inflation to real growth. So why did risk-free rates climb in the 70s? Not because the Fed wanted to, but because inflation was high. Take a look at what's happened post-2008, right? If you add up expected inflation and growth, you can see why interest rates have been low for the last 5 years. It's because we've had an abysmal economy and almost no inflation. But you're saying, but the Fed says it's kept rates low. You know whether you read the story about a rooster that would crow every morning and think that it made the sun come up. I don't remember. This is actually a famous story. It goes back 600 years. So all the barnyard animals give it all this respect. The rooster made the sun come up. And then one day the rooster oversleeps. Don't ask me how roosters oversleep, but he oversleeps. And the sun comes up anyway. And the other barnyard animals say, you never made the sun come up. The sun would have come up anyway. Do you see what this has to do with the Fed? The Fed, in a sense, is taking saying, we did it. We kept the rates low. The Fed doesn't set interest rates. In fact, what's the only rate the Fed controls? The Fed funds rate, that's it. The Fed funds rate is the only rate it directly controls. And in this graph, I've got the Fed funds rate. That's the purple line. It's been zero for the last 5 years. Does the Fed have an effect on interest rates? Yes, but it's a small little effect at the margin. In fact, what I've computed as a Fed effect is I took the T-bond rate and subtracted out my fundamental interest rate. So when that number is high, then in a sense the Fed has pushed up rates about where they should be. And of course, the number was really, really high in 80 and 81. That was the Paul Volcker attempt to break the back of inflation. The way he broke it was he basically pushed rates up to the point where the economy went into recession. So I'm not going to be saying that the Fed doesn't affect rates. Of course it does. But the Fed's effect on rates is at the margin. In fact, if you go back about 10 months at the Fed meeting, they announced that they were going to slow down quantitative, when the rate was 3.04%, they said they were going to slow down quantitative easing. They're not going to stop it, but they're going to slow it down. And people said, oh my God, rates are going to shoot up. They've really shot up, right? The rate has shot up from 3.04% to 2.43%. What I'm trying to say is we attribute so much power to the Fed when, in fact, its powers are limited. Yes?
Didn't you argue that if the Fed takes the Fed funds rate, say, to 3%, 4%, that's going to take the Treasury 10-year off as well? So you could also argue that...
No, but wait. Why would the Fed push the rates up to 3 or 4%? Because the economy is growing too fast and inflation is... In other words, the Fed is a reactor, right? So when you see the Fed doing stuff, it doesn't do it in a vacuum. It's doing it because it observes things out there. And that's what I mean about the Fed being like the rooster. Crowing is it doesn't cause things to happen. It reacts things. Of course, there's going to be this correlation. You say, Fed funds rate is high. Look, interest rates are high as well. But what came first? It's the inflation and the real growth kind of puts this prod under the Fed saying, it's going to get out of control. That's when rates go up. So at the margin, the Fed funds rate can be used as an instrument to kind of nudge rates up. But the effect is more on the short end of the interest rate, of the term. So basically what happens is the yield curve can get flatter or more upward sloping. The long-term rate is really driven by expectations of inflation and expectations of real growth. And that's very difficult for the Fed to nudge. And that's one reason why, did the Fed really want interest rates to go to 10% in the late 70s? Does any central bank want rates to go to 10%? No. But once rates starts rising because you have inflation, the Fed can stomp its feet and say, no, I want rates to go down, but it can't do a thing. The Fed is more bystander than director in this game, right? But we want to, the reason we as investors want to give this power to the Fed is it makes us feel more comfortable. It makes us feel more comfortable because we think the Fed can determine what will happen to interest rates in the economy next year when in fact it's being set by macro forces that are out of the control of the Fed. So it's time for Janet Yellen to kind of not be the center of the universe. Just like Ben Bernanke should never be. In a sense, when central bankers become, it's not a healthy place to be because investors are constantly looking for the central bank to bail them out. And I think we've been playing this game now for 3 years. It's time to say, you know what, let's go back to basics. Think about the macro variables. Let's not think the Fed, in a sense, is going to bail us out by keeping rates low while growth goes up. It's not going to happen. In fact, here's my indicator that we've gone back to a healthy economy. And the T-bond rate is 4%. Until that happens, all you're going to see is a lot of walking in place. You're going to have one good quarter, then one bad quarter. The bond market still hasn't bought into the presumption that this is a long-term, sustainable, growing economy where inflation is going to go back to 1.5% or 2%. And when that happens, T-bond rates will hit 4%. And when that happens, the Fed can go back to doing what it usually does, tweak things at the margin and not be the center of the universe. So now let's talk about risk premiums. The equity risk premium is what you demand over and above the risk-free rate for investing in the average risk investment. And that's what I said, most people estimate a historical risk premium. The historical risk premium is not rocket science. You go back in time, you take a slice of history, you look at what stocks did, what T-bonds or T-bills did, and you take the difference. So this is a table you saw in my corporate finance class that I update at the start of every year, where I take stocks minus T-bonds and stocks minus T-bills, and I look at the premium that stocks have earned over T-bonds and T-bills over historical time periods. I have 12 different premiums here. So my equity risk premium for the U.S. can range from 3 to 8% depending on what slice of history I take, whether I use T-bonds or T-bills, and finally whether I use arithmetic averages or geometric averages. Arithmetic averages, I just add up the numbers and divide by 60, 70, or 80. Geometric averages, look at the compounded return. This is incredibly convenient for you. You know why? Because you can use pretty much any number and say it's somewhere in the table. And people do this all the time. So I'm going to take away your degrees of freedom. If you're going to use a historical risk premium, you have to go with the longest time period you can get. And that sounds weird because I want you to go back to 1928, right? The year before the Great Depression. Was the U.S. equity market a very different market then? Of course. Does that make you uncomfortable? Should. But you have no choice, and here's why. Go back to the previous page. See these numbers right below? Those are my standard errors in my risk premiums. With 85 years, it sounds like a lot of data, my standard error in the risk premium is 2.34%. That's my standard error. So think about the range around my estimate with a 2.3% standard error. With 10 years of history, my standard error is almost 8.7%. So when I give you a historical risk premium over the last 10 years, I might as well have told you absolutely nothing. Right? The 3% premium could be minus 5, minus 12. It could be plus 7, plus 10, plus 15. So when you look at historical risk premiums, remember the standard error. The standard error is going to get really large with short time periods, and you need about 200 to 250 years of uninterrupted market history before a historical risk premium can actually be used with any degree of certitude. In the U.S., actually, I have to tell you, the data goes back to 1871. You're saying, why don't you go back to 1871? In 1871, the U.S. was an emerging market, coming out of the Civil War, complete shambles. So I can go back to 1871. I have more data, but I have a very, very different market. So when you talk about historical risk premiums, that's the first thing to remember. The second is almost everybody who uses historical risk premiums uses the U.S. data. I don't know, how many of you have read Stocks for the Long Run, Jeremy Siegel's book? Anybody read this? Yeah. Jeremy teaches at Wharton, and his point is that stocks always beat bonds or bills, which actually makes no sense at all. Because if that is true, then what should your equity risk premium of a long time horizon be? I guarantee you, 20-year time horizon, stocks always beat bonds. There's no risk. You should demand a 0% premium. But you look at the data. He's actually very careful. He shows all this data. There's no 20-year time period in U.S. market history where stocks have underperformed bonds or bills. What's wrong with, statistically, what's wrong with this thesis? What was the most successful equity market of the 20th century? It was the U.S. market. You've taken the most successful market of the 20th century, you've sliced it up into 20-year time periods, and you said, hey, in the most successful equity market, equities always won. Duh. Of course they're going to win. But if you invest in the Nikkei in 1989, you've had 26 years, right? The Nikkei in 1989 was 40,000. It's what, 20,000 now, 18,000? You're not going to make your money back in your lifetime. That's a depressing thought. It's done. You can take 25-year time periods. That is why we demand an equity risk premium, is because we're not guaranteed that we're going to be investing in the most successful equity market of the next century, right? You might think you know what that is right now. You might say it's going to be China. Nobody does. Because you've got 86 years left in the century. And lots of things can happen over that period that throw you off your initial estimate. There's a survivorship bias with U.S. risk premiums that's going to push them up because you've taken the most successful market. And until about 20 years ago, we just threw up our hands and nothing else we can do. That's the only market for which we can get data. So about 20 years ago, Dimson, Elroy Dimson, who teaches the London Business School, and Paul Marsh, who also teaches there, said, hey, this is crazy. Why are we being so U.S.-centric? Let's start collecting data for a bunch of equity markets and compute the equity risk premium by market. So this is actually from their database that they update every year now. Credit Suisse now publishes this book. It's a great book if you're interested in historical risk premium and what the markets have looked like, where they compute a historical risk premium across not just the U.S., but across about 20-something markets. They report a world average. If you're going to use a historical risk premium, and I'm not suggesting you should, this number might be a more reasonable estimate of what you actually made through history than picking the most successful market and say, that's the market I'm going to focus on. And that premium is a little smaller than the U.S. premium, as you should expect, because there are some markets that clearly collapsed and some markets that did much better. And what you're looking at is an average across markets. So when you look at historical risk premiums, keep that fact in mind. Historical data is noisy. You get a risk premium with a standard error, and you have this survivorship bias. Which leaves us with a problem, because if this is the way we estimate equity risk premiums for markets, what do we need? A lot of history, right? So if I ask you to value a Russian company or an Indonesian company, you need a lot of history. Well, what you need and what you get will be two different things. You're not going to get 100 years of equity market data in Russia. You can look as much as you want. You're not going to get 100 years of data in pretty much any emerging market, which effectively means you're left with this hole in estimating risk premiums, because even if you can get a risk premium for the U.S., getting to an emerging market risk premium is going to be tough if you wanted historical data for that market. So here's where some shortcuts kick in. And I'm going to give you three different ways in which you can go from a U.S. premium, I'm assuming you can get that premium, to a risk premium for a different market. Here's the most simplistic, and this is actually the way in which most investment banks come up with equity risk premiums for other countries. They take the equity risk premium for the U.S., which let's say they estimated using the historical data. Okay. In this case, let's assume it's 5%. So you got a risk premium for the U.S. Then they take the default spread. Remember the default spread I took out of the risk-free rate? and they add it on to the U.S. risk premium. So for Brazil, remember the three numbers we used, 2.5, 3%, 1.90, 1.44%, or whatever it worked out to, 1.5%. And I told you, pick any number, it's going to be okay, and it sounded like a strange thing to say. This is where it comes back, is if you pick the 2.53%, that will now become the number you add to the 5% to come up with a risk premium for Brazil. If you pick 1.9%, that's the number you'll add back. So the first approach to estimating an equity risk premium for an emerging market is to add the default spread, that same default spread you took out of the currency, back to the U.S. risk premium to come up with a risk premium for that country. Any questions? You're saying, what if my country doesn't have a default spread? If it's a AAA rated country, your life just got really simple. If you're a AAA rated country with this approach, you know what risk premium you'd use for Germany or Sweden or Norway? You take the 5%, you leave it at 5%. Essentially, you're saying the U.S. risk premium is the premium for any mature market, and any AAA rated country is mature. So that's the first approach. Any questions on that? So it requires a default spread. Here's the second approach, and this is how Goldman used to estimate equity risk premiums by countries. It requires two numbers. It starts with a risk premium for the U.S., but here are the two numbers you need. You need a standard deviation or a volatility number for the equity index in the country that you're interested in. And you need a standard deviation or a volatility for whatever reason, Microsoft PowerPoint and the PC took all my Greek alphabets and made them into question marks. So those are all sigmas. Hopefully they're sigmas in your notes, right? So basically it looks up two numbers. So as an example, let's suppose at the start of 2014, the U.S. risk, the premium for the U.S. is 5%. The standard deviation for the Bovespa is 21%. And the standard deviation, you know what I mean by standard deviation? I take 2 years of data on the Bovespa and I compute the standard deviation. Incidentally, if you have access to a Bloomberg again, find the index, type in HVT. Basically, that will give you the historical standard deviation in annualized terms in that index. So take 21% for the Bovespa. 18% was the standard deviation of the S&P 500. Here's the rest of the story. Think of it as an algebra problem. You're demanding a 5% risk premium for the U.S., which has an 18% standard deviation, right? Since the Bovespa has a standard deviation roughly 3 over 18, about 12% or 15% higher, the equity risk premium for the Bovespa will be the 5% scaled up by the higher standard deviation of the Bovespa. When I first saw this approach, I was pretty impressed. I said, this sounds like it makes sense. And it does, right? At the generic level, what am I saying? If you're a risky market, you must have a higher standard deviation. If you have a higher standard deviation, the risk premium will scale up. But what drives, we know that how risky an economy is or market is will drive the standard deviation. That's a big factor. You know what an even bigger factor is that drives standard deviation across markets? What happens if you have no liquidity in a market? How do I compute standard deviation? I look at change in prices, right? If there's no trading, let's take an extreme scenario. Let's say you have a market where there are almost no trades. And I compute the day-to-day standard deviation. What am I going to see? Very little. Why? Because nobody's trading. The second factor that drives standard deviation of an equity market is how much liquidity there is. What I'm trying to say is the weakness of this approach is if you take a market like Pakistan, which has very little liquidity, the standard deviation of the Pakistan equity index is about 14%. Take that to the logical limit now. If I use this approach to estimate an equity risk premium for Pakistan, what will I get as my equity risk premium? I'm going to take 18%, the S&P 500, I'm demanding 5%. This market has only a 14% standard deviation, therefore, I should be demanding an even smaller, which makes absolutely no sense that you demand a lower risk premium. But that's, I think, the weakness of this approach, is you're comparing markets with very different liquidity. So first approach, you just add the default spread. Second approach, you scale up a volatility. Here's my third approach, and this is an approach that I prefer, and I'll back it up. Remember how in the Goldman approach I compared the standard deviation of the Bovespa to the standard deviation of the S&P 500? I'm comparing two different markets, two different liquidities. I'm going to replace the standard deviation of the S&P 500 with the standard deviation of that government bond from which I got the default spread for Brazil. Remember the dollar-denominated bond? Let's assume the standard deviation of that bond was 14%, which I can look up because it's a traded bond. Brazilian equities are 1.5 times more volatile than the Brazilian government bond. The default spread I'm charging for the Brazilian government bond is 1.9% or 1.5%. Actually, 1.9% is the spread I used. I'm going to scale the 1.9% up for the additional risk. I'm just setting this up as an algebra problem. I'm trying to solve for an unknown by using what I do know. And the only number I feel any degree of comfort in is the risk premium for the U.S. and that default spread. And I'm going to try to come up with an equity risk premium for that country. So three different approaches. One is just take the default spread, use that as the additional premium added on to the U.S. equity risk premium. Second approach, take the U.S. equity risk premium, take the standard deviation of the two equity markets, scale it up. Third approach, take the U.S. equity risk premium, take the default spread for that country, and scale up that default spread by how much risk your equities are in that country than bonds. Okay. Again, do not sit for hours trying to make this choice. Make a choice, move on. It's not worth pontificating about the perfectness of the approach, how weak it is or something. Don't do too much, no, either this or that. Just pick one and keep moving, because it's not going to make an immense difference ultimately in evaluation as long as you stay consistent with it. Any questions on getting a risk premium for a different country then? So here's my 2014 update, and many of you saw this in my corporate finance class, but this, you know, this is an update I do at the start of every year where I take my U.S. risk premium, and I'll tell you how I get that. It doesn't come from looking at historical data. At the start of 2014, that number was 5%. I populate the table, every country with a AAA rating, I give the same premium as the U.S. So you'll see U.S., Canada, Australia, Germany, Sweden, all have 5% premiums. If you're not AAA rated, then I go through my melded approach, right? I take the default spread, I scale it up. I add that onto the 5%. You can see even within regions like Latin America, look at how wide the spread is. It ranges from 5.9% in Chile, which has the smallest total equity risk premium. So basically the 5 plus the, so the 0.9 is the additional premium. All the way, no surprises here, to what, 18.5% in Belize and 14.6%, and that was before Argentina defaulted. So if you looked at these numbers now, you're probably going to see an even bigger spread. So when we take regions the word and we're arbitrarily assigning the same risk to those regions, it's no longer safe because you can see how much risk varies within regions. So if you're going to operate in Latin America, I'd like to know whether you're operating in Venezuela or Brazil. It makes a big difference in what value that I'm going to attach to your company. Any questions? So now let's close the process here. So I have an equity risk premium by country. And that table I update at the start of every year because I'll be quite honest, I cannot value companies anymore without having that entire set of risk premiums by country. You say, what if you have a U.S. company? So what if you have a U.S. company? It could still have 30% of its revenues from Venezuela or Brazil or India or China, right? So in a sense, the fact that you're working with U.S. or European companies doesn't mean you can evade this issue. So here are the three choices you face when you look at a company. The first is, you can assume that every company in a country is equally exposed to that country's risk. This is what I call the bludgeon approach to country risk. And unfortunately, it's the prevailing wisdom. So every Brazilian company, I add the country risk premium for that country on top of whatever I came up with as my risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium. So everybody gets equally punished. So in the context of Indian companies, I'll be attaching the same equity risk premium to Tata Motors, Tata Steel, and Tata Consulting Services. All Indian companies with very different risk profiles in terms of where they operate. The second approach, you assume that the company's exposure to country risk is very similar to its exposure to all other risk. You put it inside the bracket. And you multiply by beta. So high beta companies are assumed to be more exposed to country risk than low beta companies. What's the logic for this? There's really no logic. It just made your life simpler, so you just did it and you moved on. The third approach, which is the most general approach, says, look, my exposure to country risk can be very different from my exposure to interest rate risk or economic risk. And I'm going to measure that exposure with something other than a beta. So I came up with this concoction. Notice how I described it. I said it's a concoction, not a derivation, which tells you there's not a whole lot of serious theoretical thought that goes into this, called lambda. And here's what lambda measures. It looks just like a beta. It looks like a beta in what sense? What's the average beta across all companies? 1. The average lambda is 1. So if your lambda is 1, you're as exposed as the average company in that market to country risk. A lambda less than 1 means you're less exposed. A lambda greater than 1 means you're more exposed. Why lambda? Initially, I called it L. But then I discovered attaching a Greek alphabet to it makes it sound more sophisticated. You said rule. Why do you think the option guys have taken over the Greek alphabet? It's their veil of, you don't understand what we do. We are talking alphas, gammas, omegas, thetas. So I stole from them. Why should they get all the fun with the Greek alphabet? So three different choices, a constant, scale up with beta, or come up with this third measure. But in all of those, I need a country risk premium. So here are your choices. You can take the lazy way out and say, look, tell me where you're incorporated and I'll tell you what your risk premium is. That's lazy because all I need to know is where's your headquarters. The second, and I think it's a much more reasonable way, is tell me where you get your business, where you operate, and I'll tell you what your risk premium should be. So let me take you through how different these numbers can be. Let's take, you know, in this case, two different companies. The first is Embraer in 2004. It's a valuation I was doing in Brazil, and I picked Embraer, one of my favorite companies to value. And in 2004, this is what Embraer's revenues look like. It was a Brazilian company that got 3% of its revenues in Brazil and 97% of its revenues in the U.S. and Western Europe. I could give it the risk premium for Brazil, saying it's a Brazilian company, but you see how unfair that's going to be? Because in a sense, it's really just like Boeing. The only difference is it happens to be incorporated in Sao Paulo rather than Chicago. So here's what I did. I took a weighted average of those two numbers in 2004. The 5% was for U.S., and in 2004, Brazil had this huge equity risk premium, 12.89%. The equity risk premium I used to value Embraer was only 5.24%. I was treating it very much like a U.S. company because of where it did business. Move forward about 7 years. This is Ambev, Latin America's biggest beverage company. I was valuing Ambev in 2012. To get an equity risk premium, I looked at the breakdown of revenues, and here's what it looks like. They get 19% of their revenues in Argentina, and already your stomach starts to drop because you know exactly what that's going to do to your risk premium. Then you get 4% in Bolivia, 9.3% in Argentina, 1.96% in Bolivia, gets about 64% in Brazil, but it also gets about 11% of its revenues in Canada. Again, I took a weighted average based on revenues to come up with an equity risk premium of 9.11% for Embraer. Let me pause there. Why am I using revenues to come up with a weighted average? Why not EBITDA or EBIT or earnings? It's very pragmatic reasons. One is revenues are one number that you usually can get by country, right? You look through the 10-Ks. The second is revenue is the only number that cannot be. Well, it's true. It cannot be manipulated, but it cannot also be less than zero. You see why that is an important factor? Because if I have a negative number and I weight based on a negative number, I'll be selling short entire countries, right? So that's the reason I stick with revenues. It's because it's easy. I'm not going to give you some construct of this is the perfect measure. But, you know. There are cases where I deviate from that rule. If you gave me an oil company, rather than focus on revenues, you know what I focus on? What's your big risk as an oil company? I look at where your reserves are, right? So if you have 80% of your reserves in Nigeria, it doesn't matter that you sell into a global market. You've got to get it out of the country. In fact, ExxonMobil is running into some issues because it's got a fairly significant stake in Russia. And now with the sanctions, it is entirely possible that that stake could go towards zero. So that's the other alternative. So I'm not stuck on revenues. If you can find a better way of assessing country risk, that's good, but don't stay with where a company's incorporated. I said that even if you're working with U.S. companies, don't assume that things are going to be easy for you, because here's Coca-Cola. It's a U.S. company, Atlanta-based. They break their revenues down by region. You're saying, why didn't they break them down by countries? Because the table will be this long, right? 75 countries, so they break them down by regions. And in the picture that I showed you, I actually compute regional averages for the equity risk premium. And I compute the regional averages by taking a weighted average of the equity risk premiums by country. Why weighted? Because if I take Latin America, I should be weighting Brazil's equity risk premium a lot more than Bolivia's, right, because of the GDP. So I take a GDP-weighted average. And the reason I take that weighted average is there are some companies where you will not get individual countries. You will get regional breakdowns. Okay? And you might have to be a little creative here, because I'll tell you one very bad habit that U.S. companies in particular have. Here's how they'll break their revenues down. And some of you ran into this in corporate finance. They say 61% of their revenues come from the U.S., 39% come from the rest of the world. Now, this is really bad operating reporting practice, because the rest of the world is a really big place. The rest of the world could be Canada, it could be Venezuela. It's a horrible practice, and I think we need to put pressure on U.S. companies to do better on this. Because I can't value a U.S. company without knowing what its breakdown is. So here's your task for today. If you picked a company, which you told me you did. So if you're lying, of course, pick a company now. Go into its 10K, look for the geographical breakdown. Use my equity risk premium for the moment if you want. See if you can compute a weighted average equity risk premium for your company. Because next session we'll start on other ways of thinking about equity risk premiums.
played there.
Where did Bauer go?